When he became president, Thomas Jefferson wanted to expand the country's territory. And his idea of exploring the continent's west had been this lifelong obsession. And this is how we got the Lewis and Clark expedition. It's the subject of Craig Fairman's new book. Fairman says there was this tension at the heart of the story. Jefferson wanted expansion, but he also said he respected the sovereignty and land rights of native people. And to understand how this story takes shape, Fairman says you have to go back before the expedition itself, to the early years of the Republic when the big questions about land and power were first being worked out. And one of these moments comes on February 25th of 1793, when President Washington had gathered his cabinet at the president's house in Philadelphia. And this is where Fairman says one of the central questions of the early republic is being asked: how a new country, which is still defining itself, would understand its relationship with the indigenous nations who already controlled much of that land. At the center of it was a tension that would run through everything that followed between the language of sovereignty and the pressure of expansion. Here's Craig Fairman.
So in this meeting, George Washington is president, and they're kind of figuring things out, not just what they should do right now, but what kind of precedents they're setting for America going forward. And the big topic for this day was a negotiation with the Shawnee and other Native nations in what would later become Ohio. The Shawnee lived on the north side of the Ohio River, and there were plenty of American people in Kentucky on the south side. But there was sort of a back and forth as Americans were moving onto the north side of the river, and the Shawnee were fighting with them and saying, no, this is our land, we want to stay here. Washington and his cabinet were talking about, well, what can we do here? Americans have some land there. Should we give the land back to them? Should we keep a land? How can we find a way to resolve this peacefully? What ends up happening is a very bloody battle. But in this debate, Washington asks everybody, well, what do you think? And Jefferson speaks up first. Jefferson says that Native people have sovereignty, that Native people control this land on the north side of the Ohio, and that they might control it forever. They're going to be the ones who choose when to give it up or when not to give it up. But Jefferson also says that America should not, as part of their treaty, give any land back. Jefferson says, at some point in the future, we'll need that land. We'll want to keep expanding. This cabinet meeting goes on. Alexander Hamilton sort of tries to undercut Jefferson. You get that dynamic back and forth between them, as so often happens in Washington's presidency. But the key thing, I think, the insight into Jefferson is that he talks about respecting Native sovereignty, but he also thinks about and plans for a future where America will grow. It's important to remember that in this time period, whether it's the 1790s or later when Jefferson himself is president, America has lots of ambitions, but it doesn't necessarily have lots of power. There's a quote where he talks about America's strength where the Lakota live along the Missouri, and Jefferson says that America is, quote, miserably weak. There are Native towns that are bigger than St. Louis or even bigger than Washington, D.C. So America doesn't have the on-the-ground power to do this. But Jefferson is very aware of the legal system and how to sort of position America in terms of being able to maintain access to that land. And especially once he becomes president, Jefferson tries to speed that process up. Jefferson thought he was doing the right things. He wanted to do this peacefully. He thought that treaties and peaceful expansion was much cheaper, both in terms of dollars and in terms of human lives, than fighting wars and expanding that way. But he also cared a lot about expanding America. I think it's an important tension in American history, and I think Lewis and Clark are one of the best places to see it because they're really our first act of foreign policy. I found this one document where Jefferson was talking to a senator, not about the Missouri River, but about the Pacific Northwest. And he said, you know, no international empire has been able to make a claim to this area yet. But that sort of helps you understand why he was sending Lewis and Clark right into the heart of that area in the Northwest.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Craig Fairman's book is called This Vast Enterprise. In a subtitle, he calls it A New History of Lewis and Clark. And that's where we began, with the question raised in a review from the New York Times. Do we really need another book about Lewis and Clark?
I promise you that I asked myself this question before I ever started working on this book, because I spent 5 years on it.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spend 5 years of my life rehashing other people's work and just telling a story that's already been told. I was only going to do this if there was something new to tell.
Mm.
But I did want to write an adventure story. I wanted to tackle one of our big, epic pieces of American history. And Lewis and Clark was the first one that came to mind. So I thought, you know, the journals that they wrote more than a million words between them and some of their soldiers. So there's this fantastic resource. I thought, let me just read through those for fun and see if there's something new here.
Hmm.
And what I noticed again and again is that there were details that even as a historian, I didn't know. That Lewis and Clark in their journals, yes, they were writing about, you know, Jefferson's imperial ideas, or they were writing about science, or they were writing about each other. But also in the margins of these entries, there would be a sentence about York, the enslaved man who came with Clark, or there would be a sentence about John Ordway, the working class sergeant who was actually in the freezing river pulling the boat and doing the hard work. And so once I realized that there were more people, and also once I saw that Lewis and Clark themselves knew that this expedition was never just about the two of them, they always knew it was a team effort, I thought, well, maybe there is something more to say here. Maybe there's a new way to tell this story that sort of makes it more of an ensemble.
Mm. You mentioned how the Lewis and Clark story is just an incredible epic, but that there are a lot of distortions in it, a lot of myth. And you mentioned in the book how you're trying to offer a more accurate account. By emphasizing these two ideas, which we'll talk about as we go, one idea being land, the other being that there were more than just Lewis and Clark there, that ensemble cast that you were just sort of referring to there. But what are the distortions that are there? When people think about the expedition, they're not thinking about York, at least not now. Until they read your book, they aren't. So what's distorted about it? How are most people sort of thinking about it that you want to fix?
Well, I really think when you say the Lewis and Clark expedition, most people just picture Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
Maybe Sacagawea is there too, but even she's kind of in the background. I mean, there are these signs all over the American West for the Lewis and Clark Trail. They're on the sides of highways, right? They're brown and white. The National Park Service puts them up, but there's only two people on those signs. And so I wanted to remind us that something that was this important and this big would always have to be a team effort. And this is not really just my idea. The title of my book, This Vast Enterprise, that's a quote from William Clark's letter to Jefferson when Clark accepted, you know, his position at the expedition. So Lewis and Clark always knew this was going to be vast, not just in terms of spanning a continent, but in terms of how many people it would take to pull it off. And I just wanted to find a way to tell the story where you could not just understand Lewis and Clark, although they're obviously a huge part of my book, but where you could understand all these other figures as well.
Let's talk about what your book does with the story, because, of course, beyond the Lewis and Clark part, it's more than that. And you really focus on some of the issues, you know, we've been saying, the other players in the story. You write this: the goal is immersion, not just in the past, but in each person's version of that past. Explain what you mean by that, how you're reframing the point of view here.
Well, let's keep it really concrete and let's talk about land.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have to travel 8,000 miles together. And so as they're going up these rivers and going down these rivers, on either side of them is land, in many cases, beautiful land. Lewis, in a letter to his mother, says this is the most beautiful land anywhere in the universe. And so they see this beautiful land. But even though they're all seeing the same thing, it means something different to each of them. When Lewis sees the land, he thinks, I need to take soil samples for the president because he sent me here on a scientific mission.
Yeah.
But when a working class soldier like John Ordway sees the land, he thinks that would be a great farm. You know, I didn't have enough money to buy farmland myself. That's why I joined the army. So to him, the land means something different. When somebody like York, Clark's slave, sees the land, perhaps he thinks, you know, that that's land that I can't own because of my position in American society. And then, of course, there are native people who, when they see the land, they think that's my home. That's where I live. That's my land. That's not for anybody else. So when you think about something as simple as land, it looks different to every single person, just like land today would look different to you or me. And so what I really tried to do in this book is not bring modern categories to the past, but rather try to show each person's point of view. So that's why the book moves in different chapters. Chapter one is from Lewis's point of view, but chapter two moves to York's point of view.
Yeah.
And by moving these chapters around to different people, I really want you to feel like you're in the canoe. I want the expedition to feel real to you, but I also want to show you that, you know, the world meant different things to different people. That's just what being a human being means.
Let's talk about the idea itself. This is Jefferson's idea, and he's had it for a while. It becomes this sort of lifelong obsession, this expedition west. And there's this moment you write about in the book. This is in the summer of 1802, when he's sitting in his study, as you put it in the book, soaking up this natural light, and he finds himself revisiting this old idea. Talk a little bit about how he's thinking about this idea, because as you say, he's tried three previous attempts at getting this thing going.
Absolutely. This was something that mattered so much to him. And I think one reason he cared so much is that he saw the potential in so many different areas. There's no question that he cared about science, that he cared about maps, that he cared about information. But he was always thinking about land, too, and about what he wanted America to look like. He loved his country, and he thought what was best for his country was to get more land, to be able to create more farms, those kind of yeoman farmers that to Jefferson, in his vision for the country, that's what made the country special, and that's what would make the country last. So he had all these ideas in mind. But of course, as president, he now finally has the power to try to do this. But he also has so many pressures and distractions. In 1802, that time period, Napoleon is causing all kinds of trouble in Europe. Yeah. And Napoleon is also getting ready to take over the Louisiana Territory. So America is soon going to find itself with France down to the south, with Britain up above, Spain off somewhere in the west, Russian ships along the Pacific coast. Mm-hmm. It's a busy continent. And we're not even talking yet about all the native people who live there and their nations as well. So there are so many pressures. And Jefferson realizes in that summer, I've got to do this quickly. If I don't get this expedition sent off soon, Napoleon's going to show up and do an expedition of his own. It was one of those real hinge moments where you can see that, you know, if things had gone just a little bit differently, the continent might look totally different today.
So someone close to Jefferson says that this area was fit for colonization. It's ripe. And so Jefferson realized, as you say, he needed to act quickly. So let's come back to the idea of his intentions. What were his intentions for the native people he knew Lewis and Clark would encounter along the way? Because one thing that's so interesting that you write about is he spends a lot of American taxpayer money on these Indian delegations to have Lewis and Clark tell them, come to Washington. And so what was the point of that? What was his intention? I mean, he didn't intend to just screw them out of all of their land. What did he have in mind, at least at this part of the story?
Sure. Well, this is one of those times where you really have to try to see the world the way that it looked in 1804, because if this was a book about Andrew Jackson and his views of native people, it would be totally different. But in terms of Jefferson and the Enlightenment ideas that he cared about, he wanted the land, but he also thought that his ideas would be good not just for Americans, but for native people too. Jefferson wanted to educate native people. One of the things he told Lewis and Clark to offer was, you know, if you find any young native children who want to be educated in America, send them back to America and we'll take care of their education. And so Jefferson wanted to make deals. He wanted to make trades and slowly sort of buy native land and while also teaching them how to be farmers. But I mean, here's the thing that we have to say about this is that these were all Jefferson's ideas and Jefferson's priorities. Even though he wanted to be kind to these people, his kindness did not include a realization of what they might want or what they might want to do. I mean, there were already native people farming. The Missouri River had lots of nations who were good at growing corn and beans and squash. And so when Jefferson says, let's go teach them how to farm, that reveals kind of the myopia that he has and how while he doesn't want to start a war and just steal land, he also doesn't really see the native people as full human either.
He says that the object of your mission to Lewis and Clark would be to find the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent for the purpose of commerce. Okay, so that's there. That's that practical thing that he has in mind. But also, you see, sort of fueled by these Enlightenment principles and this deeper philosophy, he wants to have Lewis and Clark observe plants and animals and minerals and the climate and native cultures. And he wants them to make not just one copy of these journals, like make a bunch of them and put one of them, write one of them on the paper of birch. So talk a little bit about it's a grand notion, it seems like.
Well, in this time period, all the stuff you're describing was connected. So commerce, science, ideas, land, they're all versions of the same thing. Because Jefferson is not just worrying about the native people and their claim on the lands. He's worried about France and Spain, and they're sort of like an extra level of imperial claims on the land through international law, what was called the Law of Nations in this time period. Mm-hmm. And so if America wants to claim this land, one way to do it is by sending American fur traders there. And so maybe they build a private fort and they start making deals. And there's also maps that Lewis and Clark are going to make. And those scientific discoveries are going to be published in Europe, written by American authors. So each one of these steps is sort of like a brick, and brick by brick, you're slowly building the American edifice, the claim to these kinds of lands. All of these things matter to Jefferson. He was very curious about all of these things, but they were also sort of facets of the same idea, which is that America needs to find a way to claim this land. You could claim it through military might, but you could also claim it through scientific knowledge or mapping or commerce.
I want to ask about Lewis, Meriwether Lewis. Give us a sense of who he was. I think his kind of curiosity about and his observation toward the natural world seems to be a key in some ways to his character. Do you think that's right?
I do. I think he was somebody who may have been more comfortable around plants and animals than he was around people.
Yeah.
He was somebody who had a very exacting mind. One small moment, but I think it just tells you about something, is early on in the expedition when they're still on the Ohio River, Lewis brought a dog with him. He was an animal lover, and the dog would chase squirrels and catch the squirrels, and then they would eat them for dinner. But Lewis would find himself watching those squirrels, and he would watch how they would swim and how different swimming strokes would create different ripples in the river. And then he would think, well, what does this mean about their migration patterns? When do they swim? When do they not swim? And you can see how something as small as a literal ripple in a river just sends his mind in all sorts of interesting and scientific directions. But that's how his mind worked. He would notice the small thing, and then he would try to connect it to the big thing. And that's one of the reasons the expedition produced so much amazing information. But I also feel like it had to be exhausting. If you're somebody where a ripple in a river is going to send you on a scientific reverie, then everyday life, I think, will wear you down. But Lewis was up for it.
Yeah. He must have been had a kindred spirit relationship with Thomas Jefferson. He was, of course, Jefferson's secretary, chief of staff is probably the right way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, you've talked about when you look at Lewis's journals that you can get a sense of something that becomes obvious to those who know him, that he suffered from depression that's what Jefferson said. He said Lewis's
right.
depressions of the mind. But you say you can sense the way he thought about the world by looking at his journals, that he's not just studying the natural world, he's also studying his own mind. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I think so. The way that he would notice a ripple and then sort of analyze its repercussions, he was doing that with his own emotions and thoughts at the same time. And this is very rare in this time period. Remember, this is 1804. This is not somebody who's going to therapy, and it's not a culture of disclosure and confession like we live in today. But Lewis would notice things in his mind. He would notice, I'm worrying about the future. Or, I keep obsessing about something bad that happened in the past. But I really want to emphasize that was only the first step, because then he would try to stand up to those things. He would notice, this tendency to worry about something or to feel dark about something. And then he would try to remind himself, we need to keep going, or that's not the truth. That's just the way your mind is framing it. And so in a way that the word I would use for it is heroic, honestly. He would notice that his mind was being overwhelmed by these thoughts, and then he would try to stand up to them. I'm not saying that he always succeeded, but he tried, and he tried to keep going, and that's one of the reasons he was such an effective leader.
You say Clark was soothed by a sunset. Lewis studied the sunset. I think that's an interesting revelation.
Well, that just comes from reading those journals where they both write about sunsets, but the sunset means something different to them.
Yeah.
It's just like the land, right? Yeah, there's one sunset, but every human being is going to feel differently about that sunset. And in this book, I really tried to capture the different feelings. Even these two captains who were best friends, they felt very differently about things. And I wanted each person in this book to feel like a real human being.
Craig Fairman. His book is called This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Lewis and Clark expedition, which is a story you think you know, but the historian Craig Fairman says many of the people who made that journey have been left out. His new book tells the expedition through the eyes of the people whose world Lewis and Clark were moving through. Indigenous people, working class soldiers, enslaved men. For Jefferson, the West represented science and empire and possibility. For Native nations, it was already a political world that was powerful and fully known. Fairman shifts the perspective and shows how it marked the beginning of a transformation that would change the continent. The book is called This Vast Enterprise. Let's talk about William Clark. You write about him as being really good at fitting in. He was good about bringing people together. He had this, you describe, this hearty and kind of welcoming laugh. He was worried about judgment and approval, but he kept that mostly to himself, maybe talked about it with his good pal Lewis, of course. But tell us a little bit about where he's coming from, Clark.
Well, I think Clark is one of those human beings who he really likes people, but he really needs people to like him back.
Yeah.
And so he cared a lot about people. He was a wonderful commander to his men. One thing that makes Lewis and Clark so interesting and unique, and this is really something that's pretty new in my book, because I went and before I studied Lewis and Clark, I studied how do normal companies work in this time period? How do normal military officers treat their men in this time period? Mm-hmm. And one thing that becomes clear very quickly is that Lewis and Clark are much more forgiving toward their men. They will still whip their men if they need to. They will still punish men if they try to desert or mutiny. And there was some of both during the expedition.
Yeah.
But Lewis and Clark tried to forgive first. And they also tried to bring the men in and let them really have a lot of input. The men would vote on various matters and get to have a say, which is not the norm in the Army during this time period. And so I think in that you can really feel Clark's leadership and Clark's example. He wrote letters when he was a soldier. He and Lewis both started out in the Army in what is now Ohio, and that's where they met each other as well. And in his letters, Clark would talk about this unthankful, unpolished service. He felt like the Army wasn't giving him enough credit. And Clark was always very aware of, you know, who was getting what credit for what. And so I think he tried to run once he got to be in charge, once Lewis was in charge and they were making their own world and their own society. I think they chose to do it in a different way with really remarkable results.
Yeah. It's interesting, of course, though, as you write about, he doesn't extend that same kind of generosity or thoughtfulness to York. And that was a difference between the two. I mean, I don't think we know what Lewis thought directly about things like slavery. Clark owned a human being. He owned York. And one of the things you write about in the book is that it was at the end of the Enlightenment when race started to become this salient idea. And that Jefferson had argued, you say in the book, that black people were genetically and always going to be inferior to white people. But Native people could change, which is really interesting. And you say those ideas appealed to Clark. Where does that fit in this story? We'll get to York here in a moment. But where does sure. How was he thinking about all of that, Clark? And Jefferson, for that matter.
Yeah, well, they thought about these ideas. Clark thought about them through college. One of the new things I found was documentation that Clark actually went to college. And sort of the received idea of Clark is that he's this folksy Kentuckian who's kind of good with men, but maybe uncomfortable around ideas. And what I would say is that, yes, he's good with men, but he also is very curious about ideas and that he went to college thanks to the documents I found. And so in college campuses, that's where these sort of Enlightenment ideas would circulate, where according to Jefferson, according to a lot of the textbooks that Clark studied, black people were sort of biologically fixed. Their position was not going to change. And I mean, from today's perspective, we can see pretty transparently that that's, you know, a justification to keep slavery in place and to keep the system that had made people like William Clark and Thomas Jefferson very wealthy, to keep it from changing. But they did have a different view of Native people, which, you know, they would study Native art or they would study Native speeches. And they would say, you know, we can see in here an intelligence that feels similar to our own. And we think that over time, Native people can change. So this Enlightenment idea of Native people being able to change was one of the animating impulses behind Jefferson's ideas about expanding America, is that he thought Native people could be assimilated and that they could change. And William Clark was exposed to those ideas, and he cared about that stuff too.
Hmm. When does he come to, own York?
Well, he grew up around York, but at that point, Clark's father was the one who owned York. Right. Clark's father also owned York's father. Their families were enmeshed in the way that American slavery created. And so once William's parents die, he inherits their plantation and he inherits some of the enslaved people on it, including York. But they had sort of grown up together all along. And York was not just a regular enslaved person. He was Clark's body servant, which in that time period meant that he would sort of lay out Clark's clothes and make sure Clark was getting enough to eat, sometimes even cook for Clark. He really took care of Clark's person. But I would say one thing here, which is that York was able to become Clark's body servant because that's what York wanted. You know, that role was reserved for the most talented slaves. And York was a big, strong guy. He could have said, I'd rather just, you know, chop down trees and have a simpler life. Instead, York clearly made choices to stand out and to be an exemplary body servant to the point where Clark took him to the Jefferson White House years before the expedition even happened. But Clark's not the one, I think, who gets the credit for that. It's York, who is very good at understanding his role and understanding how to do what Clark wanted. It's just that once the expedition started, York started to get some different ideas, and those are fascinating to trace as well.
The imagery you provide for York during the expedition gives us a sense of what the book is doing with some of these other characters. And with York in particular, you mention how on the Missouri, he, as you put it, reveled in the water and the wind and the sensation of movement. And while the other men were talking constantly, you know, in these meandering conversations while they were along on the expedition, that he probably mostly kept silent. Most of all, you say, just stayed busy. And it gives you a sense of sort of where he fit. At least he got a lot of work done. He was respected. But it just gives you a sense of his place in that journey.
Yeah, and this is where the journals really helped me, because once you're trying to tell York's story and not just Lewis and Clark's story, different things stand out to you. So one thing I noticed is that for the first few months on the expedition, the men will write about York, but they always just say Captain Clark's slave or Captain Clark's man. But at a certain point, especially once York starts interacting with some of the native nations who are very impressed by York because they've not met a black person before, then all of a sudden the American soldiers start writing, York did this, York did that. And so that's just one word. But I think the fact that they started using his name, also, of course, I guess the fact that it took them months to use his name, but in both details, you can sense sort of the relationship and the gaps that existed between York and the other men, and also the way through his hard work that he was able to slowly overcome those gaps.
Say a little bit more about the way the indigenous people would react to – they had never seen a black man. They were curious about the color of his skin, whether it would rub off. But how did they – as you say, they came to sort of have this curiosity but also a kind of deep respect. Would you just talk a little bit more about that? Those encounters? Those are really interesting.
Yeah, they're fascinating. And so York obviously had black skin. In Clark's journals, he says that York's skin was, quote, black as a bear. So he was somebody who had very dark colored skin. And many of the native nations on the Missouri River had never seen a human being like that. The other thing that's important to understand, and I learned this by interviewing native people today, is that in many of these cultures, black was a very potent color. It could symbolize war or spiritual power. And so when somebody shows up who's covered completely in blackness, you know, their first thought is that this is somebody who's painted in this way for a really good reason. And native people would go up to York and they would spit on their hand and then try to rub his skin to see if they could rub the paint off. Well, once they realized it wasn't paint, that was just his natural skin color, he became only more interesting to him.
One of the things you really explore in the book is native people as like political actors, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think a good way to sort of start talking about that is by talking about a man named Black Buffalo, this Lakota leader. He's a really important political figure that Lewis and Clark and the group encounter along the Missouri River. He wasn't sort of just a spokesman for all people, but he was a very respected leader, I guess it's important to say.
Yeah, I think both points are important to keep in mind, in that he did not speak for all of the Lakota, but he was respected by all of the Lakota.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Lewis and Clark's meeting with the Lakota, which was a very tense four-day encounter, sometimes it sort of felt like a standoff. That's one of the most famous moments of the expedition. But that's when I was writing my book, I decided, let's move the spotlight. Let's not talk about this encounter from Lewis and Clark's point of view, which has been done many times before. Let's talk about it from Black Buffalo's point of view. And this is where it's really important to remember that he did not speak for the entire Lakota, because there was a rivalry within the Lakota that predated Lewis and Clark by years. It was between Black Buffalo and another powerful leader named the Partisan, and they had very different ideas about what the Lakota future should look like, just like Jefferson and Hamilton had very different ideas about what the American future should look like. But one of the reasons I think Black Buffalo was so cunning and strategic is that when Lewis and Clark showed up, he realized, I can use these outsiders not just for my people, but to help win my side of this internal argument. And so, you know, we're used to thinking the Americans wanted something from the Lakota, and that's undeniably true. But in my book, I try to remind us the Lakota wanted something from the Americans, too.
Yeah. Say more about the delegations that come to Washington to see Jefferson, and the uniforms that they're given, or the coats that they're given. Mm-hmm. How does this work? What are Lewis and Clark expecting? What is Jefferson expecting? Tell us how that works.
Well, these kinds of delegations had been around for a long time. Different imperial powers had used them, but they'd never been done on this kind of scale before. So Jefferson basically gave Lewis a blank check and said, you know, send as many people as you can who are important. Taxpayers will cover everything. Just get them to St. Louis and we'll take care of it from there. And so Lewis and Clark invited almost every important leader to go all the way back to Washington, D.C. and meet with Jefferson. You can sort of think about it as the expedition in reverse. While Lewis and Clark are moving west, you know, thousands and thousands of miles, there are dozens of native leaders who are moving thousands and thousands of miles to the east. Now, not every native leader did it. Black Buffalo, for instance, they invited him. He declined to go. But many native leaders did. And so in one of my chapters, I tell the story of one. I'm always trying to get this book, you know, on the human level. And so I talk about this guy named Biahito, who was an Arikara leader. He lived in what is now South Dakota. And so he traveled thousands of miles down the Missouri River to St. Louis, then by horseback across to Washington, D.C. to meet with Jefferson. And Jefferson, you know, wanted to impress native people. He wanted them to see, you know, Philadelphia, the biggest city in America at that point. And he wanted them to see big American ocean-going ships with all their cannons. But native people had things they wanted, too. We know from some documents Biahito left behind and then some conversations he had with other people in Washington that were written down in their journals. We know that Biahito was really interested in trade and that he wanted to show Jefferson, you know, the Missouri River is not empty. It's full of all these different nations with all these different priorities. Biahito was a veteran diplomat of the Missouri River. He could speak about a dozen different languages. He had lived there for a long time. He understood these different power bases and interactions. And I really wish we could travel back in time and be there in the White House for this moment when he and Jefferson sat down and just talked with each other about, you know, ideas and politics. These were two world-class political leaders trying to come together and understand how they could, you know, negotiate and engage in diplomacy.
How long does he stay there? Because he tragically isn't able to go back home.
That's right. He's there for a couple months, as most of the native leaders generally would be. But unfortunately, he was an older man and he got sick. And so he ended up dying, which was obviously a personal tragedy for him. But it ended up being a political tragedy for both the Arikara and for America as well. Because Henry Dearborn, who was Jefferson's Secretary of War, he realized the gravity of the situation. So he personally selected a trusted trader to take a lot of gifts and Biahito's personal belongings back to the Arikara. But of course, we're talking thousands of miles in 1806, so it takes a long time for them to get back there. The Arikara people, I think very understandably, don't buy this idea that their leader died of old age. They think that the Americans killed him. And so it ends up inciting a really tough and intense standoff between the Arikara and the Americans that has all kinds of ripple effects. Unintended consequences, I think, is the way that I thought about it, where Lewis and Clark are trying to be peaceful and create these delegations. But as we often see in history, you know, you have one plan and then something completely unexpected happens instead.
Craig Fairman, we're talking about his new book. It's called This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Craig Fairman. We're talking about what he calls his new history of Lewis and Clark. The book is This Vast Enterprise. Well, let's talk about probably one of the most powerful characters in this story, and that, of course, is Sacagawea. And I want to read from your book to sort of get us into the story. This is how you begin this chapter on her life. You said Sacagawea wasn't even there when her life changed forever. And you're writing about something that happens, of course, in November of 1804. And the man who was her husband, Charbonneau, heard about this expedition. And as you put it, he headed to Fort Mandan to see if he could find an angle for himself, which gives you a sense of the kind of person that he was. But this is our way into Sacagawea. We'll talk about her sort of kind of tragic beginnings in a moment here, but tell us how important she is to this story.
Well, I think she was one of the most important people on the expedition, and she's also just one of the most fascinating human beings in global history. I mean, there are more statues of Sacagawea than there are of any other woman in North America today. And so I think that speaks to the power of her story. But, you know, when we hear her story in elementary school or when we see one of those statues, she's generally, you know, pointing or being a friendly tour guide. And there is truth to that. But it was really important for me to sort of excavate the backstory behind it. To me, Sacagawea was not the wife of Charbonneau. Yeah. She was the slave.
Yeah, you say that was a euphemism. Wife.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Wife was sort of the polite way to talk about it. But there's an interview after the expedition where Clark tells the truth. Clark says that she was a slave. So this is not just a modern idea being projected back into the past. When she was 12 or 13 years old, a group of raiders from a nation known as the Hidatsa attacked her nation, which were called the Shoshone. And most of the Shoshone people were able to escape, but Sacagawea was not. So she was kidnapped and enslaved. She was taken more than 500 miles back to the Missouri River and what is now South Dakota. And so she spent a few years living there. Eventually, she was bought or traded to Charbonneau. And remember, she's 14, 15, 16 years old during this time period, and he was her owner. Yeah. We know that he beat her. We know that he impregnated her. She had a very dark and difficult life, and I try to be honest about that in the book.
I want to back up, though, and talk about what her life was like before she becomes kidnapped, because it just gives you a sense of how much more tragic the story is. You write about that where she was with her family, that gender provided a source of stability, that it was a structure for survival in the sense that women, you say, you know, watched the kids and prepared food. And there was a flexibility. You say the whole family would come together to assemble these fish traps. That was a principal food that they would eat. And she had a large family. She had several older brothers. She had at least one older sister. They celebrated these forms of kinships. She would go along with her father on these long trips. She followed her mother everywhere. She felt conflicted about going away from home to do these buffalo hunts. I mean, there's a really deep portrait of her life before this tragedy happens to her.
That's right. And it was so important for me to get those kind of tactile details because, you know, it's easy to make Meriwether Lewis seem like a complicated human being because we have his journals, we have other books that are written by him. But my number one goal in this book was to make York or Sacagawea feel just as complicated and fascinating as Lewis or Clark, because we know they were. They were all human beings who were all part of this incredible story. And so, you know, I was able to rely on anthropologists who about 100 years ago at this point had interviewed Shoshone people and sort of asked them about their food ways. But then there would also be details in the journals. Like, you know, at one point during the expedition, when food is starting to become pretty scarce, Sacagawea chops up the bones from an animal they were able to kill and boils them to extract the grease. And so you can see she's trying to squeeze every single calorie out of this animal that she can, which helps her and the expedition out a lot. But she learned that as a young child because her people had to do the same things. Where they lived in what is now Idaho and what is now Montana, calories were hard to come by. And so what her mother taught her and what the other women in her tribe taught her was how to, you know, collect and manage the resources to keep people alive. And she was able to teach some of those same lessons to Lewis and Clark.
What role does she play in the negotiations with some of the native people? I mean, you mentioned she doesn't speak English ever, but she does
had mastered a sign language. So she's able, so how is she communicating, and what role is she playing in that way?
Well, this is one of the new points of emphasis in my book is sign language, because we know from contemporary accounts that Native people were incredibly good at using sign language. When Biahito went to the White House and met Thomas Jefferson, the thing that impressed Jefferson most was his command of sign language. Mm-hmm. And so this was sort of used all across the plains, and there are small but telling details in the journals, if you look closely, that Sacagawea was very fluent in sign language and that she would use it to communicate with the men. John Ordway, who we were talking about, he didn't just like Shakespeare, he liked sign language and learned that. So he and Sacagawea were able to communicate in that way. And so she was able to say what she wanted and speak up for herself and also communicate ideas to the captains, whether it was, you know, this landmark up ahead, my people know this, so we're getting close to where we'll meet the Shoshone and be able to trade for horses. But she helped in those ways, but she was also helpful just symbolically. Clark writes about this, where other Native nations would run into the party and they would see, oh, there's a woman and of course a baby, because Sacagawea had her newborn son with her this entire time. And when the other nations would see this, they would realize this is a big party of white guys with a lot of guns. But if they're traveling with a woman and a child, then maybe they mean peace. Maybe we can negotiate instead of just getting right to the fighting. So she was very important in that way.
Well, there's so much that I'll sort of there's so much we can't get to about the really critical parts of the story. They're, them, of course, ending up at the Pacific, just drenched in rain for days and days and days. Their trip back, of course. But let me get to the sort of what it all meant, I suppose. When they return, there were these series of treaties that had been established. And there's this real contrast, it seems, between what seemed to be the possibilities of peace and coexistence. And the reality of what happened. What can you say about that part of what they may or may not have accomplished, I guess?
Sure. Well, I think it's really important at this with this kind of question to take it nation by nation, because, you know, if you want to say, well, Lewis and Clark versus the Indians, what happened? Well, a lot of things happened because it's not the Indians, it's the Blackfoot and the Lakota and all these different nations with different cultures and different agendas. So if we take the Lakota, things turned out really well, actually. You know, many historians think that because of that standoff that Lewis and Clark versus the Lakota was a bad outcome. But I used a very overlooked transcript of a later meeting to show that actually they were able to create a durable alliance that that sort of shaped the War of 1812 even. So that's one place where you can see the impact of Lewis and Clark. But that's not all the stories turn out in such a happy way. The Blackfoot people, very understandably, after, you know, one of their men gets killed by the Americans, they turn against the Americans. And so there becomes real hostilities between the Blackfoot and the Americans that also lasts for decades. A number of the soldiers who went with Lewis and Clark, you know, once they made it back to America, they got these rewards. They were heroes, but they found themselves sort of tugged back to the West. That was the life they knew, and that was the adventure they missed. And a lot of the regular soldiers from Lewis and Clark's expedition ended up dying in battles with the Blackfoot because of the hostilities that had been jump-started by this encounter between Wolf Calf and Lewis. So what did Lewis and Clark produce in terms of foreign policy? Some good, like the Lakota, but some very tragic, like the Blackfoot.
You know, one of the really important mandates that Jefferson had was for them to create this expedition account, to publish a book, the journals of the expedition. As you say, they wrote a lot of words. You read them, a million words. But Lewis fails to get the account published. And I wonder what you make of that. One of the things you mention is that Thomas Jefferson isn't really helpful in getting the book published in the end. And I wonder what you make of that.
It's a real mystery, and one thing that helped me at least be able to see the outlines of the mystery, if not the answer, was this new letter I found from John Quincy Adams. Because we talked about Lewis's depression and what the expedition cost him. But once Lewis made it back to Washington, D.C., he had dinner with John Quincy Adams. And I found this letter that nobody had seen before. And in this letter, John Quincy Adams, even though he knew Lewis, said, you know, when I sat down to dinner with this guy, I could not recognize him. He looked like he had aged 15 years. So there's no question that the expedition took a lot out of Lewis, and that plus his depression, plus all the other jobs that Jefferson piled on him, it put him in a really tough position to be able to write this all-important book. But what I find myself wondering still that I don't know that I can answer is, if John Quincy Adams could see this, why couldn't Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah.
Jefferson knew Lewis better than anyone. And so I don't know if it was just Jefferson was excited about the possibilities, or I really just don't know. Maybe sometimes historians should be okay to just say, I don't know. But what I can say is that it's heartbreaking in that Lewis was put in a very difficult situation, and he spiraled because of some of the foreign policy outcomes we've been talking about, and he ended up killing himself. Yeah. And he did not finish his book. It's a really tragic outcome, especially when you factor in everything he sacrificed. I just don't understand why Jefferson didn't see that and didn't intervene more. I mean, maybe Thomas Jefferson asked himself that same question, but he never wrote about it.
So what do you think after 2 years? They didn't come back, of course, with the Northwest Passage, but they did have an incredible tale, as you say in the book.
Right.
What difference did it make, that expedition? How did it materially change the United States?
Well, it sped everything up. It taught American people to think about their continent in a different way, and not just American people, people all around the world. Because although Lewis wasn't able to write the book, Clark, with the help of some other people, was able to get a book out there. And this book was reviewed everywhere. It was a huge publication, and it was very important at this time period. And so even as Lewis and Clark were on their way back, literally as they're coming down the Missouri River trying to make it back to St. Louis, they're meeting with fur traders, and the fur traders are saying, well, where should we go? What's, like, you've been there. What's the best place to go? What's the plan? And so they supercharged commerce. They led to a new trading post in the mouth of the Columbia. Lewis had always said this is the most important thing to happen, and thanks to their example, it did. So what they did was they sped up Americans, not just American expansion, but sort of America's continental thinking, that American people were able to sort of understand the West as a real place and a place with real value. And it sort of set the tone for what would happen across the rest of the 19th century.
Craig, I want to ask you about one more story, finally, that you write about in the book. It's this moment with Meriwether Lewis on June 13th of 1805. And Lewis had been, I think he was scouting ahead of the main party. This was in what is now Montana. And he reaches the Great Falls of the Missouri River. And I think he calls it the grandest sight he had ever beheld. Mm-hmm. And you write about this moment, and then you write about him returning to that spot on the trip back. Tell us about the story, and what is it that you saw in there?
Sure. Well, the Great Falls are why the portage had to happen. They were this huge obstacle. So I think, you know, probably a part of Lewis's mind, the part that could be anxious, the part that could worry, was thinking, what are we going to do next? How are we going to be able to get around this? And they were able to get around it thanks to the work of John Ordway and the other men. But at the same time, Lewis's first reaction was to just see this as a grand sight. And so we know in 1805, the first time he saw the Great Falls, he was the first American to ever see this magnificent sight. It was a wall of water, 100 feet tall, 300 yards wide. So, you know, we can imagine the rainbows in the air, the water rushing over, the sound, the mist. It was must have just been so incredible to see that. And so what Lewis did is he sat down and he wrote. He pulled out his notebook and he wrote down a description of the falls that would be in the book he hoped to publish once he made it back. And he sort of second-guessed himself because he's a writer and that's what writers do. But he tried to capture those details. He wanted everything to be perfect. And that moment in 1805, I believe that it must have felt like perfection to him. He was seeing something important and he was recording it for everyone to know. But of course, that's only the first part of the story. The second part of the story is in 1806, on the way home, they see the waterfalls again. And this is actually what I use to end the main part of the book, is Lewis coming back to those waterfalls. Because in 1806, he says, you know, the waterfalls aren't quite as impressive. The river levels are lower. And that's true. I mean, the waterfalls were lower. But I also think something had changed in Lewis, too. You know, it wasn't just the natural object that had changed. The observer had changed, too. But Lewis says something important. He says that even in their reduced state, the waterfalls are still a grand object. And so the reason I wanted this scene to end the book is because I love Lewis. I love all of the people that I wrote about in this book. I didn't want the book to end with something sad or something tragic for any of them, even though sad, tragic things do happen to them. I wanted the last image people had of Lewis to be him doing what he did best, which was observe nature and be a scientist and be brave. And so him seeing the waterfall, whether it's in 1805 when he's still full of hope, or whether it's in 1806 when things are starting to crumble, I wanted to capture him in nature doing what the president had sent him there to do and what he did because he, you know, believed in his country and believed that, you know, he could do something to help his people.
Craig Fairman, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Craig Fairman, his book is called This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Jill Tuft. Aidan Oneida is our social media producer. The program is produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.